Welcome home. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. Baltimore Positive. I would pull my Maryland Lottery tickets out and promote the Crab Cake Tour and all of those things we're going to be doing next month as Luke gets ready for baseball season. We get ready for a new owner. We got all this stuff going on, but I stop everything for rock and roll, especially when they're not playing football games right now and there's no March Madness to be mad about or any of that. I would love to tell you that this segment came about, honestly, but it really came about because of Blondell Miller-Schuler and Todd Schuler, our dear friend here. I went to Las Vegas in early November to see U2 at the Sphere and took some pictures, put some stuff up, and Todd Schuler commented, and I had a little comment about the album Octung Baby, or I offered an official apology to John Keller, my high school chum, because I didn't love Octung Baby when it came out. Sort of went through some phases with Zooropa and Zoo TV and Squeezing Lemons and Satellite Dishes and stuff. Then I fell back in love with U2 and it was all good. We traveled the world together. We had beautiful music together in several continents. But I went to Las Vegas, and on that night, I apologized because I had some U2-isms and some So Cruels and some Ultraviolets and stuff like that, but just basically apologized. And on my thread, Todd Schuler said, and I quote, "Octung Baby is the Joshua Tree plus Violator," quoted by Rob Harvilla. And I said, well, this Rob Harvilla fella is a fella I need to get to know. Of course, I'm familiar with his work at The Ringer. He is a Clevelandite and I guess a Buckeye and an Ohio, but not really. All you Ohio people stick together except when you vote. Please go the right way this time. Rob Harvilla joins us from The Ringer, and he writes books about the 90s and 90s music. Dude, I let my hair out for this. This better be good.
It's wonderful flowing locks. You know, it's a great honor to me to see this hair, if this is a rare occasion for you. I'm jealous that you saw that you went to the Sphere. I did not go. My parents went and told me all about it, but I did not have the pleasure of seeing the Sphere in person myself. And so that worked for you in the end. You enjoyed yourself.
Well, a guy's doing a biopic on me, so I'm kind of like looking through all these old pictures and this crazy stuff after 25 years of doing this. You must have really cool parents. You just threw your parents in, and I'm like, I've been looking at pictures of my parents camped out for AC/DC tickets for us for those about the rock tour, got
That's
us tickets.
Cool.
So I was a music critic in the 1980s when I was 15 years old. I had editor at the Baltimore Sun said, "Do you know who Steven Tyler is here? Take some calls." And next thing
there
you know,
go.
I'm like 300-400 bylines deep into being my own version of Almost Famous. And all these years later, guys like you are really doing it. I went on, did sports radio, Super Bowl. You know, all I really, really wanted to do was write another Fast Times. You know what I mean? I just wanted to be the guy with Rolling Stone. And you're that guy. And I admire what you do for music, brother.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say. When I was a teenager, all I wanted to do was write for Rolling Stone. I applied to one college here in Ohio because it was a good journalism program, because I wanted to write for Rolling Stone. That was my stated ambition. I never quite made it there, you know, close enough. I think everything worked out for the best. And I get to talk about the Smashing Pumpkins for money, you know, now. And that's a pretty cool thing in and of itself.
I got a rejection letter once from Rolling Stone.
Ooh, that's an honor. 90, Did you frame
91.
It or
it was
anything?
Kind of cool.
All right. Yeah.
No, I have it in a box. I wouldn't trust it in a frame. It's got to be in a box, man. You know?
Yeah, I guess so. You got to preserve that for your archives, you know, when you give that to Princeton, you know, a couple decades from now.
What did your parents think of your ambitions to basically be Cameron Crowe?
Man, they were into it. They were very supportive and they were very kind about it. And I'm so grateful about that in retrospect. Certainly majoring in magazine journalism in 1996 is a very intense, you know, severe choice. Like, that's not something that you can do now. I imagine that my parents had a lot of trepidation about going into journalism, you know, and about trying to write about music for a career, but they were supportive. Like, I remember so vividly in high school, I went to like a summer writing workshop that concluded after a week with like everybody reading their poetry, you know, that they'd written. And it was all this super angsty, you know, moping
were
teenage
any drugs
poetry
involved. I just need to ask.
No,
that's
how
okay.
uncool it was. That's how uncool an environment this was, that it was just everybody, you know, just reading Tom Robbins, and being sad, and not hooking up with each other, or at least I wasn't. But like my parents sat there for 2 hours and listened to a bunch of teenagers, emote, including me. And I was so grateful to them in that moment for how supportive they were just being there. So they are responsible for me still being around and still doing this, for better or for worse, hopefully for better, but I'm very grateful nonetheless.
Anybody that knows my journey knows about my sports thing. And, growing up with the Colts here, we lost the Colts and the Mayflower. I've did sports radio here pretty capably for about 3 decades, through all of it, all the Cal, all the Ray Lewis, all that. Mm-hmm. And I sports became like a vocation for me and like the thing I had to do to pay my bills. Love it. I've forgotten more about sports than any, but rock and roll makes my blood pump. And I'm 55 years old. You know what I mean? Yeah, so,
sure.
And it's the one thing, I'm surrounded by Pacifica belt buckles. It's the one, I don't collect baseball cards, although I did 40 years ago. I have like a Super Tramp and a Van Halen and a Bee Gees belt buckle. So I'm more of the disco meets Zeppelin, totally Hairspray. 70s, everything about Poison, 70s, everything about Guns N' Roses. 70s and into the 80s. I could be the you of that. We have Mike Brillhart to do that here in Baltimore on 100.7, who's my buddy from Hammer. I was the Hammerjacks backstage guy. So that's my era, right? I'm not BSing you. So I worked at the paper from 84 to 86 and 86 to 92. 1992, I left. Camden Yards opened in Baltimore.
There it is.
My last name's Aparicio. And I never really wrote another music story after writing probably 500 on every genre you could possibly, every rock star, 100 Hall of Famers, and cold turkey in 1991, 92. And it's right when Nirvana and Pearl Jam and it stepped in. And I still loved music. I was still a Hootie and the Blowfish guy and all of that gin block, all of that. But I didn't do it from chasing somebody at PolyGram trying to get an interview and going back. I didn't do it. It was cold turkey. It was all Mike Messina, Cal Ripken football after that. But I've been going to concerts and it's my thing. I travel the world for concerts. It's taken me to Australia to see Bruce. It's taken me to Europe. But your 90s thing is just fascinating to me because I didn't interact with music journalism in the 90s. I just interacted with the music. So seeing your thoughts about how it all melded together when you were my age, when all of this other stuff happened, it really is generational, right? And whatever music you listen to when you're 18, it's yours for life. And then you've chronicled it all these years later.
That's what I've come to realize is the music you love as a teenager is the music that's going to be most important for you. And hearing Nirvana at 13, versus hearing Nirvana at 23, or hearing Nirvana at 13, 20 years later, right? It's cool now that teenagers now are still getting into Nirvana, or at least still wearing the t-shirts, right? But there is no replacing the real-time experience. I was like you. I grew up on MTV, on 80s MTV. I loved, hair metal, and it's not that I stopped loving hair metal the moment, the Smells Like Teen Spirit video premiered for the first time, but I totally, as a teenager, bought into that narrative that grunge killed hair metal, right? And Guns N' Roses.
But it did.
Yeah, it felt like, if you were watching MTV, it certainly did, but just going from Guns N' Roses being the biggest band on earth, in 1990 to Nirvana being the biggest band on earth in 1992, that whiplash effect coinciding with the whiplash experience of being a teenager, there's no replacing or replicating that, whether you were born earlier or later.
Well, to him being dead 3 years later and the Foo Fighters still being this extension in the way Wings was to the Beatles, to the, to whatever.
The Wings.
Listen, I got to go back to the original quote. Cause this is how literally how you wound up on the show. Violator and Joshua Tree are probably, for me, if I got on an island and I only had 10, they would be two of the 10.
Desert Island. All right.
They would
good
be
choices.
Two of my 10. Yes.
Excellent choices. That's legit.
So how did the Octung Baby reference happen? I need to know this.
Well, U2 is an interesting, I grew up listening to U2, and in the 80s, U2 meant, Heartland's arena rock, right? Like the Joshua Tree, Unforgettable Fire, like that's where I got into them. And my mom and my mom's brothers loved U2. Like my mom took me to see the Zoo TV tour, the Octopus Baby tour
Your
in like
mom's U2
19.
was probably my U2, which is like sort of Bono on a barge and rain falling at Red Rocks, right?
That's
Like
right.
literally,
Yes.
right?
Yeah. But I, it, so it's interesting the experience. U2 feels like a different band in the 90s. And like Octopus Baby is a classic, sort of universally agreed upon. Like Joshua Tree and Octopus Baby, I think, are of a piece as their peak for a lot of people. Not everybody, but a lot of people. But I do have a lot of, there's a lot of charisma to later to 90s U2. When they get a little shaky, when they go a little too far with like irony and dance music and like MTV and like image making, Zooropa and Pop are like very weird records, sort of uncomfortable, sort of awkward, but in a way that's really endearing for me. But something that I love about U2 is that they have these eras, they have these eras for me personally, like what stage of my life I was in, but, from like up and coming. Like punk rockers, like post-punk rockers, as into Joy Division as anything else, to like On Top of the World from the Joshua Tree forward, to like in this weird sort of ironic dead zone where they're not quite the cool thing anymore, but they're still really, really trying by the mid-90s. Like it's cool to me how many different eras of U2 there are now.
I think for bands that survived that period of time, and I'm thinking of like Rush because I'm a Rush guy, but bands that
Totally.
really, the beginning, the middle, and the end were very, very different books, very, very
Right.
different sounds, different instruments, different voices, just different everything with the
Right.
same artists, right?
Yes.
No other different pieces where like Clapton played with everybody and Ronnie Wood played with everybody. Yeah, and you move around from band to band. These are the same humans, just
Right.
being into different. Look, I saw Sting with the Philadelphia Symphony Orchestra on Friday night with
Yeah.
my wife. Made her very, very
Wow,
happy. My wife
I'm
loved
sure
that,
you
right?
did.
I have
Yes.
seen Sting now in the Synchronicity tour at the Capitol Center with REM in 1983. I've seen them in
With
stadiums.
REM? You saw the Police and REM
REM opened
together?
up for the Police
Gee,
on the 83
holy
tour,
crap.
Synchronicity. Yeah, you can look that one up.
I'm jealous of that. I
Well,
would
it's
have loved
true.
to have seen that. Yeah.
Yeah, but so I saw all these eras, and REM's another band, and they broke up and just said we're done and we're out. And Mike Mills is playing with orchestras now down in Atlanta, right? There's
Right.
a period for your music where, your people aren't as old as like me. You know what I mean? Like I'm very interested to see what the Green Days and what, I mean, some of the '90s artists are leaving us as well. But like the next chapter, to your point of what does come next for some of these artists that are John Mayer evolving, always evolving, right?
Right. Now he's in the 80s. John Mayer is somehow evolving. John Mayer is becoming dad rock in real time, but John Mayer is also, a part of the Grateful Dead extended universe. Yeah, John Mayer is a fascinating case. There's the Dave Chappelle era. There's sort of the heartthrob era. There's the bad boy era. There's the sort of fake country, Cormac McCarthy era. And yeah, it's yeah, John
I
Mayer is
love the Sob
a
Rock era, if that matters. I mean, he took a hell of a
Oh, I
band out
love,
last year.
yeah, that's a great record. That's a really cool record. And it's cool because it's like a guy from the early 2000s who's reminding me of the 80s, but now it's,
Go listen to
2020.
Clapton's Journeyman and you like right into that groove or the same
Right.
groove
It's
right
awesome,
there.
dude. It's legit. I saw that tour and I really, really, really dug that a lot.
Yeah, well, I saw
But
the
of
tour
course, I
too, and I
would.
saw it weird because like I was at the Garden the night everybody got COVID, so he just came out and played on it. Questlove came in
Sure.
like an Uber and saved his ass, and they got up and they're doing Vultures. Rob Arville is here. I've waited, well, only since the '90s, not a whole lifetime, only a half a lifetime to have him on. Tell everybody what the Ringer is, just in case they don't know. And
Yeah.
it's a little bit of everything now, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's sports and pop culture. That's what it is. The Ringer is a website, started by Bill Simmons, the very famous sports writer, culture writer, podcaster, Bill Simmons. So it's a website and it's also a pretty healthy, pretty robust podcast network, where it's not 50-50, right? But it's like half sports. half culture. And I am for sure on the culture side, on the music side. I've had this podcast I've been doing since 2020. I'm coming to it pretty late. The Ringer's been around since 2016. There was a site called Grantland. It was an extension of ESPN. That was sort of Bill's first big thing. But yeah, it's the combination of sports and pop culture, the combination of a website, and a podcast network. We do documentaries through HBO. We got a lot of stuff happening, but I'm just hanging out here in Ohio, just trying to keep my head down, and just doing my little stories about you two and whatnot. I'm having a great time.
Here's something that gets me to be an old guy. Two topics here. Festivals in general, just the festivals, right? Where like you can't piss, you can't get in, you're weather related. I don't want to be a get off my lawn guy, but it's not necessarily the way I want to experience music,
Of
right?
course it
And I
isn't.
don't need to be up on top of it, but it feels like these festivals, I don't do most of them. If the weather were perfect in Ocean City last year, Sheryl Crow, they would, it, Dave, it would have gotten me. But the weather wasn't, it doesn't need to be
Need
72 and
perfect.
sunny, but it just needs
Right.
to be comfortable to be out 12 hours. I don't do rain and cold. So
Of course.
that is one topic. And the other one is etiquette. And one sort of leads to the other because festivals are a party and whatever, lawn
Sure.
seats. I am so effing frustrated with spending a lot of money. I had eight of the nastiest, drunkest 55-year-old women yelling at me at a Toto concert, Rob Arvilla. They were
Toto.
screaming at me during
Why?
ballads at it. I don't understand. Like, get a
Were you
different drug, get a different.
disruptive?
But
What's going
people,
on?
just people who talk during concerts.
No, I
Like,
hate
can we
that.
fix
No.
this, man? You have
You
clout,
can't.
dude. You have street
Do
cred.
I? I don't know
Yes.
that I do. I can't make the ladies at the Toto concert shut up if that's what you're asking me. I don't have that sort of authority. I can commiserate with you. I can share in your sorrows. I'm too old to go to festivals. Partly this is a child's rearing situation. Like I can't leave this house basically. And so you're not going to see me at Coachella or whatever, but I'm like you. Like I'm not going unless the weather is perfect and I have a chair, and I am a certain, pretty short distance from the stage. Like I'm just not doing it. But no, like people talking during concerts, it's a terrible curse. You should be able to spray them with a hose or something. But I, Toto, though, like just this conflict transpiring while Toto is on stage is that's a
And
lot of
listen,
discord for me to
it
process. Like, man,
happens
that's
in
tough.
every city, at every show. It happened at a symphony hall during Sting the other night. It happens when John Mayer
Sting.
is singing Comfortable and you can't shut up, for the one,
Yeah.
three times on the tour he does it. Rob Arvilla is here. He writes books. All right, let's talk about your book because the
Okay.
90s and I. This whole thing began with me in the 70s and 80s, and I'll read a
Sure.
Zeppelin book. I'll read books on my bands. You, however, have sort of taken on the whole genre of anything that was written during that period of time and finding sort of a modern place for all of it.
Yeah, I was a teenager in the 90s, right? I went to high school, I went to college, and this is the music that imprinted on me. There's an inherent nostalgic quality to me writing a book about the 90s now, right? But I do think that a lot of this music is still present tense. I still think people, young people even, are still listening to it, and the music being made now by young people is still influenced by it. And I'm curious about the difference between Nirvana as I experienced them as a 13-year-old in 1991 versus like the myth of Nirvana now, right? Like somebody, a kid, a teenager now who buys a Nirvana t-shirt in Target or whatever, or their parents buy it for them. Like, what does that band mean to them versus what that band meant to me at the time? I'm sort of interested in sort of interrogating the difference between the myth and reality of the 90s themselves. But I do think that the 90s as a culture, as a decade, as a period, as an epoch or whatever, like it does hang together. It does feel coherent. It does feel distinct in a way different. I don't think about the 2000s or the 2010s the same way. I think that we have a better defined culture. And I'm trying to figure out if that's just because I was a teenager at the time or whether I'm on to something there.
Does that make the Foo Fighters the wings of the Beatles to
You are
someone
absolutely right
younger?
about that.
Because
I mean, listen,
I have memories in 1976 with my dad. Now, my first 45 was Got to Get You Into My Life, Flipside Helter Skelter, right? I also, my other,
that's cool.
The other three were a Starland Vocal Band's Afternoon Delight. And this is before Will Ferrell. And the other one was Neil Diamond, If You Know What I Mean. So this is 1973, 74. And
pretty cool
I
kid.
Then heard Let Him In, the Wing song, Someone's Knocking on the Door, you know, right? And Silly Love Songs. And it didn't equate to me that Paul I'm 8 years old, I'm 9 years old, right? So it didn't equate to me that one's the other. Once one became the other, he became Paul McCartney, and he became, and there's Lennon and Candlestick and, you know, Ed Sullivan and all that. But I think there's a point where if you're a 13-year-old kid and you're at Target and the happy face of Nirvana, the same one that I bought at, when he played American University that night, I saw him there at Bender Arena.
I'm jealous again.
Right. You know, I mean, I'm just older, dude. I'm just older, you know, so I'm just older. That's all there is. I saw Sean Cassidy in his prime too, but we don't talk about that here, you know?
All right.
We don't talk
let's
about
not.
That. But I do wonder, for a 13-year-old where I had WLPL, I had it all. Every one of these belt buckles was predetermined by me from Saturday Night Fever through the disco era, through your experience with MTV, where everything was sort of funneled at you to some degree. And then radio went away, or is going away, or on, it was well on its way to be going away, and Napster and all that. Young people now, when they see any young band there is, Dua Lipa, pick anything that's sort of a new thing, to say where they find that on their journey. And the Taylor Swift thing is just beyond Beatles and Elvis to me in the modern era.
Right.
So it's still, it's still sitting there for bands, but I think it's so much harder to latch on to something.
Yeah, I mean, nobody sells as many records anymore, you know, as they did in the 80s and the 90s. You know, I was thinking about, you know, Taylor Swift is probably the biggest cultural phenomenon, musical phenomenon, since probably Michael Jackson at this point, you know. But the, like, how huge Michael Jackson loomed over me, you know, in 1984 when I was 6 years old. I've never had that feeling again, even with her. You know, and so it's sort of an easy shorthand to say that partly because of the internet, right? Like, the culture is scattered now. You know, there isn't a monoculture. We're not all watching the same TV shows. We're not all watching the same movies. Like, everybody's picking their own, you know, everyone's got their own algorithm, their own bubble. They're into their own thing, you know, and there are far fewer intersection points than there were in 1992 or 1982, you know, and I think that's mostly a good thing versus a bad thing. You know, my kids having the choice to get into anything and not having to pay $20, you know, to buy, you know, a 30-minute CD, like, that's a great thing that they can do anything that they want. But it does lead to this scatterbrained sort of feel, where, like, it's, the culture feels less distinct now than it did when I can just very blithely summarize the 80s as Michael Jackson now. Like, you can't do that so much in this era, even if maybe Taylor Swift is proving us wrong.
My wife just started that We Are the World doc the other night. I'm only 20 minutes into it.
I
want to
see that.
Don't let me know how it ends.
That.
I don't need to know how it ends. I mean, I know the song. It's fine. Rob Arville is here from The Ringer. He writes books about the 90s. I every once in a while, I get a wild hair because people think of me for sports, and I've been known to opine about politics and whatnot. But every once in a while, just put one line out. Like, last week, I put Air Supply or Little River Band, pick one. You know what I mean? Like, so I throw that sort of thing out, but I threw something out about 9 months ago that created, like, a really long thread. And all I was really trying to do was, like, put together a playlist, like a mixtape, like what people my age would call a mixtape. And I said, what's the greatest song ever written?
What? Wow. Yowza.
Right. And you know the worst part, Dave Shinen, and you're in the sports world to some degree. Dave Shinen's Washington Post reporter. He's a musician. He's a beautiful guy. He does the theme song for all my music here at Baltimore Positive. Dave came on the thread, and he wrote Sarah. And I thought, I'm going to go back and listen to Fleetwood Mac. And I went back and I listened to Fleetwood Mac. I had him on the show 2 months ago. I grabbed my Fleetwood Mac Pacifica belt buckle. I brought it out. He said, no, the Bob Dylan Sarah. And I'm like, come on, man.
I was going to say.
Come on, man. You know? So what's your number one? Come on, give me
greatest song ever written. Holy moly.
Who's ever asked you that?
No, not. I don't know if anyone ever has. Let me. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. All right. Okay.
It's always mood related, isn't it? It depends on what the lighting is and how you're feeling and, whether you want to rock out or whether you want to be romantic, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I have to.
You'll get back to me?
No, it feels like a niche thing for me, but I Common People by Pulp immediately popped into my head as, in my opinion, one of the best written songs in any genre of all time. And I can say that as a 90s guy or whatever, but I think there is a quality, an anthemic and sort of an articulate quality that that has, where that's one of the all-time greats. Of course I wanted to jump right to like Prince or the Beatles or whoever, and that's probably objectively the right answer. But I think one thing that I love about the 90s is that there are songs that I do think stand, with the ultimate pantheon. And I'm gonna just sort of honor the first thing that popped into my head and
What
say
are
that
they then?
Common
Come on now,
People.
because you're always making these cases that the 90s were the greatest cross section to back and read from the back of the book cover now, Rob.
You can, you can. I know what it said.
Pick a few more. Pick a few
Okay,
more songs
sure.
because the reason I did this thing 9 months ago and I got that Sarah thing wrong was just to go back. You know what? The last time I had a music guest was about 3 weeks ago. I had Rick Emmett from Triumph on. And the whole reason he wrote a book. The whole reason I had him on was someone on that thread wrote Magic Power. And I went back and I listened to it and I'm like, that's a effing
Dope.
great song. And then
Okay.
6 months later, I had him on. So that's why you're just giving me little nuggets here. I'll remember
Okay.
anything you say. And Todd Schuller and
Good.
I will remember this as gospel. So whatever you say, I'm going to add
That's
it to my
intimidating.
playlist and reconsider the song.
Well, geez, man, I would have to think, as I said, Prince has to be, probably, is it just Prince, like When Doves Cry or Kiss, or Purple Rain, if you want to do that? There has to be a Prince song in there.
You didn't say that, did you? Because last week I tweeted out that I would die for you on any hill, that Cream is Prince's best song.
Wow, that's a great choice. That's a fantastic song, a 90s song. There you go. Cream. I don't know if I would say the best song ever, but that's, again, that's in the pantheon. I totally respect that opinion. Cream is a great song. Beatles wise, I would probably go Let It Be. I would, like Missy Elliott's Work It, is one of my favorite rap songs of all time, early 2000s. I think that has to be in any greatest song of all time conversation. Like U2 wise, like you got to put something in there, and that's going to be, again, there are micro eras. You could say With or Without You, you could say One, you could say Where the Streets Have No Name, like that might be it for me still. The first band I ever loved, dude, honestly, was the Cars. That was the first, and so I that whole album, really, it's like Just What I Needed by the Cars. Are you pulling out a Cars belt buckle?
Well,
That was
dude,
a, you're
I
getting
mean,
some.
come
There
on,
it is.
man.
That's,
You know,
yes,
like
two.
you
You got
ask,
two
and
of
I
them.
have three actually. I
You
can't
have
reach the other one
three.
right now. Yeah, the other
That's
one's a gold one.
phenomenal.
Yeah, oh, I'm
How
holding it
many
upside
belt
down.
buckles do you have
Well,
total? I've never heard of this
several.
collecting several.
Several. Yeah, I have several. Well, it actually all
Okay.
started with my Led Zeppelin belt buckle that I bought at KB Toy Store in
Okay.
1979,
At
and it's sort
KB
of the
Toy
spread
Store.
eagle
Yeah.
Zeppelin eagle thing.
Sure.
And I
Yeah.
own that belt buckle for 35 years. And
Okay.
after my wife survived cancer the second time, she was
Oh,
trying to
my
do something
goodness.
nice for Christmas for me, and she surprised me because I never had a belt to wear it on. It was a
I
standalone
was
belt
about
buckle
to
that
ask if
never
you were a
really
belt
owned that.
buckle
I was
guy.
never that kind of
Okay.
belt guy. I wasn't that cool. I never had a jean jacket either, but don't cry for me. So my wife saw, and she knows I love Rush. She went on the Rush website and they had remanufactured a modern version. And she bought me a belt and it was beautiful. I had two belts. And I'm out drinking wine one night with John Allen from the Charm City Devils, my childhood buddy. He sees the belt. He's like, hey, I got an Aerosmith one. I have a Zeppelin one.
What?
And he said, I have a Stevie Wonder one. I'm like, you have a what?
Ooh,
So then
that's
we
cool.
went on the internet and then it cost me a lot of money. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I
Actually,
was about to
this was the
say.
first one I bought, dude. This one was the first one that caught my eye, literally. This was
That
the
is extremely cool.
And so I lend it out to my buddy Ron West, who's in the in a band, and
Yeah.
the Cultivated. But they don't do just cult music. But I let him wear the belt buckle of his choice because they're cool and they're fun. So the Cars,
I
man,
love the
that
Cars.
you know, like, that's a great bass line. If you love the Cars, we can hang out. Like, seriously.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Drive. I love the Cars song Drive. Also, that might be my favorite song of theirs overall. But that first Cars record was the first album I ever loved, you know, as a like a 4 or 5 year old. And so something from there has got to be in the all-time pantheon. I don't
Oh.
have a belt buckle of them. I'm not about that life, apparently, but I got to get
How
out
old
there
were
once.
you when you saw Phoebe Cates get out of the pool in Fast Times? I just need to know.
I was not late teens. I
Okay.
did not have that association with moving in stereo
Well,
immediately. I mean, I certainly
once you
understand
had
why
it,
it
you
was
never lost it.
formative. Exactly. Yes. I caught up fast, but I used to think that song was sung by Darth Vader just because it had a Darth Vader sort of sound to it. So I did not come to that song the way yeah. Never
Man, that
mind.
bass line hook. So I'm going to leave you with
Yes.
this because Todd
Okay.
Schuller is your biggest fan. He reads all your work and is a devotee.
Awesome.
Yeah, and he's
Yeah.
a local lawyer, but don't hold that against him. He's a reformed
I won't.
politician, but he was on the right side of the world and wants good causes and doesn't believe in insurrectionists and criminals.
That's
He
nice.
wants me to ask you, this is Ask Rob Harvilla. Ask
Great.
him how we're supposed to celebrate our first St. Patty's Day without Shane McGowan and Sinead O'Connor. And the reason I'm
Oh, that's right.
I bring that in
Shit.
because the Prince song, right? Nothing compares to you. So when we think
Yeah.
about great Prince songs, we think of Sinead with that, but that is a great Prince song.
It is a great Prince song, but it's one of those cases, you know, it's like respect, right? Like Aretha Franklin stealing a song from Otis Redding. You know, I can appreciate the original version, you know, the original Prince version eventually we got to hear of Nothing Compares to You. But what's so amazing about that is it's Sinead's song. Now, you know, as much as I love Prince and revere Prince as one of the all-timers, like that's a case where she owns that song, you know, and there's no greater accomplishment as a pop singer than to own a song from one of the greatest, like Prince. And so, yeah, I had not
Like
made
Kenny
that connection.
Rogers, like sort of owns Lady, even though Lionel Richie wrote it, kind of
That's
sort of.
right. It's
All right.
very much like that. Yeah. And so, but no, you're absolutely right. You know, obviously, Dolores O'Riordan from the Cranberries has been gone a few years now, but no, this is a very different St. Patrick's Day for that reason. And I hadn't made that connection, but that's a tough one. That's a super tough one. You know, both enormous losses, you know, but Sinead that was a wild story to go back and, you know, to read about and to read about like Saturday Night Live and just how revolutionary she was, like, you know, in real time. It was just such a cool, really tragic, but still really honorable story.
What's coming up on the podcast? Give me a little preview here, and we'll let you get on your way. And I hope you come back, you know, once a year or something
I'd
like
love
that. We'll
to.
vibe
Whenever,
out stuff.
dude.
Any guy that's got that stereo behind them still that I had, that
Oh, that's
Marantz from
right.
like
Okay.
'84,
The Marantz. I got this on
perfect.
eBay, dog. Yeah. All right. I want to hear more about your belt buckle. So I'll be back absolutely for certain. As we speak, it's Monday. On Wednesday is the final episode of this show, the 120th and final episode of the inaccurately named, obviously, 60 Songs That Explain the 90s. You know, I felt like I could do this forever, but I felt like I should stop at some point. And so this is it. We're going to go on and do something else very soon. The show will be back. But as far as the 90s is concerned, the last episode is this week, and I need a break just physically, you know. But I am very sad finally to be leaving this decade behind after like 4 years of my life. You know,
You're
it's been
not
so
leaving.
cool to
What
do.
else are you gonna do? You're the
It's a good
90s guy.
question.
Own
It's a
it, dude.
very good question.
You're
I am
typecast
that.
now. I mean, be
There we
Bobby
go.
Grady for life. Own it. Put
Wow.
on the Johnny Rep.
Okay.
Own the 90s. People love you, man. They love you.
You've convinced me. Okay, so it's just another normal episode coming out on Wednesday, and I'll keep doing the show forever. You've absolutely convinced me that I should just
Listen,
keep
there's
doing
at
the 90s.
least 60 more songs for you to find, right?
Up there
I
at
mean,
least. Yeah. Oh, totally. I haven't done like the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones yet, dude. You know, there's plenty left on the table that I'll get to now, thanks to you.
when I found this radio station in 1998, the people that had it was a failed kids radio station. So we're celebrating
Ooh.
25 years, right? They had a loop
Congrats.
tape and the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, the impression I get, played every, because it was for kids. That, you know, it had sort of that
The
look
very
that,
children's, yeah.
yeah. So when I think of that, I think of this. And I will always think kindly of you. I appreciate your time and your candor and your sense of humor. Everybody appreciates your work. I encourage everybody to go out and get the book, especially if you are a child of the 90s, or even if you were like old enough to be like drinking beer and chasing girls in the 90s. It was still a good time to be listening to music. And when I hear Nirvana, even though you think one thing and I think another thing, we probably both think the same thing. It's pretty good, right?
Pretty much.
Mean, rock and roll.
It's pretty good, right? Is a good way to summarize it.
You know, soothe your mortal soul. And so, hey, take care of yourself, Rob. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much, dude.
Rob Arvilla from The Ringer. He does podcasts. He writes books. He is the 90s guy. Whether he wants to be or not, let's own it because it's awesome. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. Stick with us. We're going to get back to some Baltimore positive, talk some sports at some point. Music's more fun anyway.